The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
51551 Ray at RTE.ie. Now, back on June the 18th, 1994, Ireland were playing Italy in the Giant Stadium in New York. It was their opening World Cup game of that USA 94. You might remember Ray Houghton scored that historic goal and we beat them 1-0. There were a number of men in a bar in Lochan Island in County Down, Heights Bar. And 5 minutes after Ray Houghton scored that historic goal, gunmen walked in and shot men in the back. Six of them died. Adrian Rogan, age 34, Patrick O'Hare, age 35, Eamon Byrne, age 39, Malcolm Jenkinson, age 52, Daniel McCraner, age 59, and Barney Green, who was 87. They were all locals and they were all Catholics. That night became known as the Lochan Island Massacre, and it's the subject of a documentary called No Stone Unturned by Oscar-winning documentary maker Alex Gibney. The documentary gets its TV premiere tonight on RT1, and Alex joins us from a studio in New York. Good afternoon, Alex.
Hi, Ray. How are you?
Good to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming into the studio, and congratulations on the documentary.
Thank you.
So, why did you do this? Because you're an American man. You've no links with Ireland, do you?
I mean, distantly. A few generations ago, some relatives of mine were from Ireland. But I think it was because a colleague of mine, Trevor Burney, got me interested in the story. At first, we did a short for ESPN. And then, having become involved in the story, and I was so poignantly impressed by the survivors of the massacre and their plight to try to find out literally what happened, because so few people were seemingly engaged in trying to get to the bottom of this story. So the documentary, in a way, was a way of finding out what happened.
The timing, it being the night of a historic World Cup game for Ireland, that was one thing, but there was other things about the timing of it as well, because it was just months before ceasefires by the IRA and the UVF.
That's right. And there's a lot of suspicion that perhaps the police were either told or pressured not to investigate too thoroughly, so that, you know, finding the culprits of this massacre would somehow upend the fragile peace process. So, and a number of survivors in the film suggest as much.
So a lot of people in Ireland will be seeing this for the first time tonight. It was on cinema release, but people will be seeing it for the first time tonight. How do you think they're going to react to your documentary?
It's hard for me to say, and maybe not for me to say, but I would say this, that I think that, you know, there are important reasons to dig back into the past. But I should say that as American, it wasn't my intent to relitigate the Troubles or to bring back the Troubles as a way of saying, well, this side was right or this side was wrong. There is a kind of, there's obviously an intense Irish element to this very deep Irish conflict. But I think there is also a universal element to this story. One is, what happens when the state gets involved in illegal activity, and then in order to cover up that involvement, resorts to claiming secrets that are there for the purpose of national security. So those are things, you know, all over the world, governments tend to get involved in things that they shouldn't, and instead of protecting citizens, they end up hurting them. But to cover up their tracks, they always invoke national security, and that's a kind of broader theme, I think, that is nevertheless relevant here. So it has a key local element, of course, that should be of great interest to all people in Ireland and Northern Ireland. But I think it's broader than that.
And the Rogan family, the daughter and the wife of Adrian Rogan, you seem to have a very close relationship with them. 25, it's 25 years on now, Alex, and it appears to me, although the end of the documentary is around 2016, 2017, they still haven't got any justice, have they?
No, they still haven't gotten any justice, and no sign that the police, the PSNI, are even investigating anymore. I think that that may be one of the most frustrating things, when your own government just turns its back on you. Even in the face now, we found pretty convincing evidence of who the suspects were. The only investigating seemingly that the PSNI have done is investigating into the filmmakers themselves. After all, two of my producers, Trevor Burney and Barry McCaffrey, were arrested by 100 police, all bearing weapons, very early one morning in front of their kids.
100 police?
That's my understanding. Right. 50 went to see Barry and 50 went to see Trevor, approximately. And it was a large contingent in any event. I wasn't there. I was in Russia at the time. But and then they were taken to the police station. And the idea was that they were briefly being accused of stealing government documents. That's not true. Documents were leaked to us as part of the, investigating process. But ultimately, that warrant, which was thrown out by a judge, but it was a long time that arrest and prison hung over the heads of Trevor and Barry, and to some extent myself, for trying to investigate what the police should have investigated.
Yes, and you have named suspects in the documentary, and people will see those people named tonight when they watch it at 9:35 on RTE1. Were you worried for your own safety? You've mentioned what you've mentioned, but were you worried for your own safety?
There's always a concern, but at the end of the day, we took great precaution both to inform the police that we were going to do this and also to reach out to those individuals themselves and give them an opportunity to respond. So, sometimes it's best, sunlight is the best disinfectant, and sometimes sunlight can be a pretty good protection too, I think.
Yeah, but I suppose by naming them, and some of them are still living locally near Loughan Island, and the Rogans are still living locally as well, and so they may see them as they go about their daily lives. Is that not a constant reminder of what happened 25 years ago?
It is, though I think a more chilling thought, and it's one expressed by the Rogans in the film, is that imagine them going to the supermarket and not knowing that perhaps the person next to them in the vegetable section might have been responsible for the murder of their loved ones. You know, I think to some extent our decision to name them was both a public safety issue and also an attempt to try to force the police to reckon with this massacre, this unsolved mystery, according to them.
There's an exceptionally poignant moment in the documentary when you're interviewing Aidan O'Toole. What age was Aidan? He was the barman on the night of the massacre. Was he 15, 14 on the night?
Jeez, I think he was a little bit older
than
that.
Was he? A little bit older.
But not
yes.
too much
not
more.
Not too much
yes.
older. And he says in the documentary, "I was one of the lucky ones, if you can call it lucky."
Right.
Which to me, and I can't, was him alluding to the torture he's had to live with.
Yes, well, if you can call it lucky, I mean, you can see in the eyes of Aidan the pain and anguish that still he feels. And I think he feels a survivor's guilt, but I also think he feels that terror and that fear that that any human being would know when a masked man comes in with a semi-automatic weapon, actually really an automatic weapon as it was played out, and opens fire, in what would normally be a peaceful pub. So that kind of terror just lives with him every day.
By making this, do you think you've enhanced the lives of the survivors and the families of the victims?
You'd honestly have to ask them that,
yes,
but
yeah,
I do think that they have achieved some sense of greater satisfaction. I know that for a fact because I've talked to them about it. Some sense of greater satisfaction in at last having a window into knowing what happened that night, because I think that was one of the most haunting things for them, that not only were the officials not responding to them and actually brushing them off in terms of their entreaties for trying to find out who did this and holding them accountable, but the existential dread of not knowing at all why this happened, and indeed precisely what happened and who was responsible, that was really haunting to them. So I think they've gotten a lot of answers, and that's given them some comfort. But I should say that the hard part of going back into the past is that when some questions are answered, other new questions remain unanswered. You find new ones to ask, and that, I think, is probably also difficult for them.
And do you feel that anything will happen now as a result of the airing of the documentary tonight?
I certainly hope so. Yeah. I mean, really, you know, one of the reasons for doing this was to prod two organizations. One is the PSNI, to say, come on, you can properly investigate this crime and hold people to account. Surely, if we as documentarians can get close to who committed this murder, you can. You have a badge and a gun. And in addition, I think there's a larger issue here, which is the documentary starts with a lonely red Triumph moving through the countryside of County Down. And it ends with an image of that car being crushed and thrown away in a big lot amongst a lot of other cars, sort of like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark when you see that last sequence. You know, that's where the secrets are buried. I think the other plea in this is, you know, over time, the victims demand an accounting and demand a revealing of government secrets, particularly those which shed light on government misconduct. And so it's a plea, or if you like it, a demand that the UK government open up its treasure trove of secrets.
You're very prolific. How many documentaries have you made in your career?
I wouldn't be able to tell you off the top of my head.
Yeah, it's an exciting time to be making documentaries, isn't it?
It is indeed, because people are watching them now. And I think, frankly, because they've gotten better. As storytellers, documentarians have gotten much better in terms of being able to tell tales that people want to tell. But I also think that particularly in a time when so many people in power are trying to spread fake news, to use a term from the United States, that there is a hunger for people who are trying to seek out the truth.
Mm. Your work, according to your IMDb, which sometimes isn't reliable.
It's not always, I would say it's not always 100% accurate.
Okay. It says that you're working on something called Why We Hate.
Ah, well, I can say that's coming out.
Yes.
You know, in fact, on Monday, there will be a premiere in Los Angeles. I'm flying back from London. I'm going to London tonight and flying back.
And is that as the name suggests?
It is indeed. It's an inquiry into why we hate, a sort of look at a human problem that we have, and by identifying it as a human problem, a plea to how we can rudder against those tendencies.
Right. Because people like Danny Morrison and Billy Hutchinson feature in the documentary tonight.
Indeed.
Two men who are on different sides of the divide in the north of Ireland. And there was definitely hate during the Troubles. I'm not sure it's disappeared.
I think there was. And, you know, hate is a complicated thing. Hate often springs from idealism. That's, you know, a lot of FBI agents will tell you that radical Islamists, for example, are often recruited not by appeals to hate, but appeals to love. And so what happens is that you get a sense of a mission, and therefore anybody who is in conflict with a mission, you turn to hate them. It's a peculiar variation, a human way of reckoning with this notion that the end justifies the means. Mm. And I think, you know, one of the great legacies, or I shouldn't say great legacies, but one of the terrible legacies of evolution for human beings in terms of our psychology is a tendency towards tribalism. And
well, that would have protected us in the past.
It would have protected us in the past, but in terribly complex times, and when it comes time to try to make a peace out of a conflict, it becomes terribly difficult because you tend to demonize the other in ways that are unfair.
And of course, injustice fuels hate, I would imagine.
Injustice does fuel hate. And indeed, you know, one of the things we discovered in Why We Hate was that justice, though, or a sense of justice, tends to be pretty hardwired. There have been studies done about children below the age of one who already have a pretty powerful sense of justice and injustice, and fury erupts when just injustice
it's not fair.
Shows its head.
Not
it's not fair.
It's not
Stamp
fair.
The feet.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I read that Bad Blood book. I'm fascinated by Elizabeth Holmes, and you've done a documentary on her. So you were in her company. We just tell people, just in a short paragraph, who she is and what she did.
Elizabeth Holmes was a young woman who was briefly worth about, it was some billions of dollars. She was an entrepreneur in Silicon Valley who had a came up with a blood testing technology where the idea was you could avoid the terrible needle and just have a prick of the finger. And that tiny amount of blood could be tested for hundreds of maladies. And she had all sorts of investors on board.
And the whole thing was that it was a device that you could have in your home, so you wouldn't even have to leave.
Ultimately, that was the idea. Yes, it never got to that point, but but for a while, this device was in stores, in pharmacies, so at least briefly, in one state in Arizona. It never got as far as she wanted. She wanted a device like this in every home. She wanted to be the Steve Jobs of medicine. Mm. But it turned out that the whole thing was a fraud. But what was so interesting about the story, and she's being prosecuted now by federal authorities and faces up to 20 years in prison. What was so fascinating about the story was, how could she lie so effectively? And that gets into the human psychology of lying, something I'm very interested in. And also, why are we as individuals so willing and able to be conned by somebody who didn't really present very good evidence as to why her device should have worked?
But she conned a lot of older men with power.
She did indeed. A lot of older men who, as one female scientist put it, succumbed to a certain charm. Mm. But I think that...
It's odd because it wouldn't be a charm I'd succumb to, but obviously, maybe I'm 55, maybe as I get older I might succumb to that charm, I don't know.
Perhaps, perhaps. But let's also say that these were very sophisticated men who should have been at least able to, you know, see a fraud. Henry Kissinger was one. George Shultz was another, former Secretary of State.
Very powerful men.
Jim Mattis, who had recently been Secretary of Defense. Yeah. So, yeah, they should have known better. And actually, I talked to a younger man, Tyler Shultz, one of the whistleblowers in the case, who said that, you know, even he, I don't know if he succumbed to her charm, but he succumbed to her sense of charisma or persuasiveness that he knew for a fact because he worked in the lab how bad the technology was. But he would walk up to her office and after 15 minutes in her office, she'd have charmed him and convinced him that he was on a mission. This is back to this idea of the end justifies the means, you know, which is so relevant when it comes to the troubles.
Yes.
You know, and he would go back downstairs to the lab floating on air thinking, I'm doing good. And then he'd have to shake his head and say, whoa, what just happened?
Yeah, she had an effect. Looking forward to seeing that. It's not available this side of the Atlantic yet, but I look forward to watching it. You also worked on Dirty Money for Netflix, and you produced and directed the one on the Volkswagen emission scandal.
Hard Knocks.
Hard Knocks. And then the Donald Trump one as well, because he looked into his business interests and how good he was at money.
Well, he was terrible at it. I mean, you know, he may have been one of the worst businessmen of all time. You know, he was the classic example of how you fail up. You borrow so much money that now the banks are, you know, your customer because they have to keep you going because you owe them so much money because you've blown it all spectacularly. I mean, what's interesting about Donald Trump is everything he touched was abject failure. But then he was put on this show, The Apprentice, and which was intended originally as a kind of parody, but that ended up promoting him or promoting his image as a great businessman. In fact, you know, what that particular documentary that was on Dirty Money does is to show what a pitiful businessman he was. Uh-huh. If he had just invested the money that his daddy had given him in a, you know, sort of plain vanilla market index fund, he'd have got out way ahead. It's a disgrace how bad he was.
And then he was claiming that's you need a businessman in the White House. Yeah. Making documentaries, and we've just hit on a few of them, but it in the main, your task, your job, your quest is to uncover the ugly side of human nature. Do you despair?
No.
No.
Sometimes I would say I'm pessimistic but hopeful.
Right.
And I don't despair because, honestly, you know, one of the things that if you were to take a close look of most of the films that I've done, you'd see a lot of perfidy, a lot of horrible things, but you'd also see a lot of heroism. And, you know, I was always interested in that experiment done by the Yale psychologist Stanley Milgram. It's all about obedience. You know, he has
electric shocks.
He sort of parodied in Ghostbusters. But what he discovered was that while some people under direction, and actually it was about two-thirds of the people under direction, you know, would have pressed the button that, you know, would have shocked people to death, there were a good 35% who refused to take those orders, who said, no, I'm not going to do something so immoral. And so whether it's practice or character, and I tend to think it's more practice than character, you know, we can rudder against the ill, the dark side, and we can find the better angels of our nature.
Tonight, No Stone Unturned. Where does the title come from, Alex?
Well, it's a British official says at one point, "We shall leave no stone unturned in our search for the criminals." But as Claire Rogan said, I don't believe they ever turned a stone. So, you know, no stone unturned is purposefully ironic. They did. The police in this case did not turn over many stones. In fact, they probably piled more stones on top to cover up the original one.
I think everybody should watch it tonight. I think it's a good way to teach history from the particular to the general and not from the general to the particular. So I think people will get a greater understanding of what went on up the north by looking at your documentary tonight. Alex, it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Great pleasure, Ray. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.